Appendix Lamed. The Tactics of Magic. The human brain evidently operates on some variation of the famous principle enunciated in The Hunting of the Snark.
What I tell you three times is true.
Norbert Wiener, Cybernetics.
The most important idea in the Book of Sacred Magic of Abra Melin the Mage is the simple-looking formula,
invoke often.
The most successful form of treatment for so-called mental disorders, the behaviour therapy of Pavlov, Skinner, Wolpe et al., could well be summarised in two similar words,
reinforce often.
Reinforcement, for all practical purposes, means the same as the layman's term reward. The essence of behaviour therapy is rewarding desired behaviour. The behaviour, as if by magic, begins to occur more and more often as the rewards continue.
Advertising, as everybody knows, is based on the axiom, repeat often.
Those who think they are materialists and think that materialism requires them to deny all facts which do not square with their definition of matter are loath to admit the well-documented and extensive list of individuals who have been cured of serious maladies by that very vulgar and absurd form of magic known as Christian Science. Nonetheless, the reader who wants to understand this classic work of immortal literature will have to analyse its deepest meanings, guided by an awareness that there is no essential difference between magic, behaviour therapy, advertising, and Christian Science. All of them can be condensed into Abra Melin's simple invoke often.
Reality, as Simon Moon says, is thermoplastic, not thermosetting. It is not quite silly putty, as Mr. Paul Krasner once claimed, but it is much closer to silly putty than we generally realise. If you are told often enough that Budweiser is the king of beers, Budweiser will eventually taste somewhat better, perhaps a great deal better, than it tasted before this magic spell was cast. If a behaviour therapist in the pay of the communists rewards you every time you repeat a communist slogan, you will repeat it more often and begin to slide imperceptibly toward the same kind of belief that Christian scientists have for their mantras. And if a Christian scientist tells himself every day that his ulcer is going away, the ulcer will disappear more rapidly than it would have had he not subjected himself to this homemade advertising campaign. Finally, if a magician invokes the great god Pan often enough, the great god Pan will appear, just as certainly as heterosexual behaviour appears in homosexuals who are being handled or manhandled by behaviour therapy. The opposite and reciprocal of invoke often is banish often. The magician wishing for a manifestation of Pan will not only invoke Pan directly and verbally, create Pan-like conditions in his temple, reinforce Pan associations in every gesture and every article of furniture, use the colours and perfumes associated with Pan, etc. He will also banish other gods verbally, banish them by removing their associated furnitures and colours and perfumes, and banish them in every other way. The behaviour therapist calls this negative reinforcement. And in treating a patient who is afraid of elevators, he will not only reinforce, reward, every instance in which the patient rides an elevator without terror, but will also negatively reinforce, punish, each indication of terror shown by the patient. The Christian scientist, of course, uses a mantra or spell, which both reinforces health and negatively reinforces, banishes illness. The basic Christian Science mantra, known as the scientific statement of being, no less, is as follows. There is no life, truth, intelligence, nor substance in matter. All is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation, for God is all in all. Spirit is immortal truth.
matter is mortal error. Spirit is the real and eternal. Matter is the unreal and temporal. Spirit is God, and man is his image and likeness. Therefore, man is not material, he is spiritual. The fact that these statements are, in terms of the scientific criteria, meaningless, non-operational, and footless, is actually totally irrelevant. They work. Try them and see. As Aleister Crowley, no friend of Mrs. Eddy's, wrote, "Enough of because! May he be damned for a dog!" Similarly, a commercial not only motivates the listener toward the sponsor's product, but discourages interest in all false gods by subsuming them under the rubric of the despised and contemptible Brand X. Hypnotism, debate, and countless other games have the same mechanism. Invoke often and banish often. The reader who seeks a deeper understanding of this argument can obtain it by putting these principles to the test. If you are afraid that you might, in this Christian environment, fall into taking the Christian Science mantra too seriously, try instead the following simple experiment. For 40 days and 40 nights, begin each day by invoking and praising the world in itself as an expression of the Egyptian deities. Recite at dawn, "I bless Ra, the fierce sun burning bright. I bless Isis Luna in the night. I bless the air, the Horus Hawk. I bless the earth on which I walk." Repeat at moonrise. Continue for the full 40 days and 40 nights. We say without any reservations that, at a minimum, you will feel happier and more at home in this part of the galaxy. You will also understand better Uncle John Feather's attitude toward our planet. At maximum, you may find rewards beyond your expectations and will be converted to using this mantra for the rest of your life. If the results are exceptionally good, you just might start believing in ancient Egyptian gods. A selection of magic techniques which will offend the reason of no materialist can be found in Laura Archer Huxley's "You Are Not the Target," a powerful mantra, the title, in Gestalt Therapy by Pearls, Hefferlein and Goodman, and in Mind Games by Masters and Houston. All this, of course, is programming your own trip by manipulating appropriate clusters of word, sound, image, and emotional prana energy. The aspect of magic which puzzles, perplexes, and provokes the modern mentality is that in which the operator programs somebody else's trip acting at a distance. It is incredible and insulting to this type of person if one asserts that our Mr. Nkrumah Fubar could program a headache for the President of the United States. He might grant that such manipulating of energy is possible if the President was told about Mr. Fubar's spells, but he will not accept that it works just as well when the subject has no conscious knowledge of the curse. The magical theory that 5 equals 6 has no conviction for such a sceptic, and magicians have not yet proposed a better theory. The materialist then asserts that all cases where magic did appear to work under this handicap are illusions, delusions, hallucinations, coincidences, misapprehensions, luck, accident, or downright hoax. Look up the etymology of the word coincidences sometime and see if it means anything. He does not seem to realise that asserting this is equivalent to asserting that reality is, after all, thermoplastic, for he is admitting that many people live in a different reality than his own. Rather than leave him to grapple as best he can with this self-contradiction, we suggest that he consult Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain by Ostrander and Schroeder, especially Chapter 11. From Animals to Cybernetics, The Search for a Theory of Psi. he might realise that when matter is fully understood, there is nothing a materialist need reject in magic action at a distance, which has been well explored by scientists committed to the rigid Marxist form of dialectical materialism. Those who have kept alive the ancient traditions of magic, such as the Ordo Templi Orientalis, will realise that the essential secret is sexual, as Saul tries to explain in the Sixth Trip, and that more light can be found in the writings of Wilhelm Reich, M.D., than in the current Soviet research. But Dr. Reich was jailed as a quack by the U.S. government, and we would not ask our readers to consider the possibility that the U.S. government could ever be wrong about anything. Any psychoanalyst will guess at once the most probable symbolic meanings of the rose and the cross. But no psychologist engaged in psi research has applied this key to the deciphering of traditional magic texts. The earliest reference to Freemasonry in English occurs in Anderson's Muses Threnody, 1638. "For we be brethren of the rosy cross. We have the Mason word and second sight." But no parapsychologist has followed up the obvious clue contained in this conjunction of the vaginal rose, the phallic cross, the word of invocation, and the phenomenon of thought projection. That the taboos against sexuality are still latent in our culture explains part of this blindness. Fear of opening the door to the most insidious and subtle forms of paranoia is another part. "If the magic can work at a distance," the repressed thought goes, "which of us is safe?" A close and objective study of the anti-LSD hysteria in America will shed further light on the mechanisms of avoidance here discussed. Of course, there are further offences and affronts to the rationalist in the deeper study of magic. We all know, for instance, that words are only arbitrary conventions with no intrinsic connection to the things they symbolise. Yet magic involves the use of words in a manner that seems to imply that some such connection or even identity actually exists. The reader might analyse some powerful bits of language, not generally considered magical, and he will find something of the key. For instance, the 2+3 pattern in "Hail Eris, All Hail Discordia" is not unlike the 2+3 in "Holy Mary, Mother of God," or that in the LS, MFT, which once sold many cartons of cigarettes to our parents, and the 2+3 in Crowley's "Eo Pan, Eo Pan Pan," is a relative of these. Thus, when a magician says that you must shout abracadabra and no other word at the most intensely emotional moment in an invocation, he exaggerates. You may substitute other words, but you will abort the result if you depart too far from the 5-beat pattern of abracadabra. A glance at the end of Appendix Beth will save the reader from misunderstanding the true tenor of these remarks. But this brings us to the magical theory of reality. Mahatma Guru Sri Paramahansa Shivaji, Aleister Crowley again under another pen name, writes in Yoga for Yahoos, "Let us consider a piece of cheese. We say that this has certain qualities, shape, structure, colour, solidity, weight, taste, smell, consistency, and the rest. But investigation has shown that this is all illusory. Where are these qualities? Not in the cheese, for different observers give quite different accounts of it. Not in ourselves, for we do not perceive them in the absence of the cheese. What then are these qualities of which we are so sure? They would not exist without our brains. They would not exist without the cheese. They are the results of the union, that is, of the yoga, of the seer and seen,
of subject and object.
There is nothing here with which a modern physicist could quarrel, and this is the magical theory of the universe. The magician assumes that sensed reality, the panorama of impressions monitored by the senses and collated by the brain, is radically different from so-called objective reality. See the anthology Perception, edited by Robert Blake, PhD, and especially the chapter by psychologist Carl Rogers, which demonstrates that people's perceptions change while they are in psychotherapy. As William Blake noted, "The fool sees not the same tree that the wise man sees." About the latter reality, we can only form speculations or theories which, if we are very careful and subtle, will not contradict either logic or the reports of the senses. This lack of contradiction is rare. Some conflicts between theory and logic, or between theory and sense data, are not discovered for centuries. For example, the wandering of Mercury away from the Newtonian calculation of its orbit. And even when achieved, lack of contradiction is proof only that the theory is not totally false. It is never, in any case, proof that the theory is totally true, for an indefinite number of such theories can be constructed from the known data at any time. For instance, the geometries of Euclid, of Gauss and Riemann, of Lobachevsky and of Fuller all work well enough on the surface of the Earth, and it is not yet clear whether the Gauss-Riemann or the Fuller system works better in interstellar space. If we have this much freedom in choosing our theories about objective reality, we have even more liberty in deciphering the given or transactional sensed reality. The ordinary person senses as he or she has been taught to sense, that is, as they have been programmed by their society. The magician is a self-programmer, using invocation and evocation, which are functionally identical with self-conditioning, auto-suggestion, and hypnosis, as shown above. He or she edits or orchestrates sensed reality like an artist. Everybody, of course, does this unconsciously. See the paragraph about the cheese. The magician, doing it consciously, controls it. This book, being part of the only serious conspiracy it describes, that is, part of Operation Mindfuck, has programmed the readers in ways that he or she will not understand for a period of months, or perhaps years. When that understanding is achieved, the real import of this appendix, and of the equation 5 = 6, will be clearer. Officials at Harvard thought Dr. Timothy Leary was joking when he warned that students should not be allowed to indiscriminately remove dangerous, habit-forming books from the library unless each student proves a definite need for each volume. For instance, you have lost track of Joe Malik's mysterious dogs by now. It is strange that you could make the clearest possible statements and yet be understood by many to have said the opposite. The Rite of Shiva, as performed by Joe Malik during the SSS Black Mass, contains the central secret of all magic very explicitly, yet most people can reread that section 10 or 100 times and never understand what the secret is. For instance, Miss Portinari was a typical Catholic girl in every way, except for an unusual tendency to take Catholicism seriously, until she began menstruating and performing spiritual meditations every day. These two signs of growth often appear at the same time, being DNA-triggered openings of the fourth neural circuit. One morning, during her meditation period, she visualized the Sacred Heart of Jesus with unusual clarity. Immediately, another image, distinctly shocking to her, came to mind with equal vividness. She recounted this experience to her confessor the next Saturday, and he warned her, gravely, that meditation was not healthy for a young girl,
unless she intended to take the oath of seclusion and enter a convent. She had no intention of doing that, but rebelliously and guiltily continued her meditations anyway. The disturbing second image persisted whenever she thought of the Sacred Heart. She began to suspect that this was sent by the devil to distract her from meditation. One weekend, when she was home from convent school on vacation, her parents decided she was the right age to be introduced to Roman society. Actually, they, like most well-off Italian families, had already chosen which daughter would be given to the church, and it wasn't her. Hence, this early introduction to La Dolce Vita. One of the outstanding ornaments of Rome at that time was the eccentric international businessman, Mr. Hagbard Cellin, and he was at the party to which Miss Portinari was taken that evening. It was around 11, and she had consumed perhaps a little too much Piper Heidsieck when she happened to find herself standing near a small group who were listening raptly to a story the strange Cellin was telling. Miss Portinari wondered what this creature might be saying. He was reputedly even more cynical and materialistic than other international money grubbers, and Miss Portinari was, at that time, the kind of conservative Catholic idealist who finds capitalists even more dreadful than socialists. She idly tuned in on his words. He was talking English, but she understood that language adequately. "Son, son," Hagbard recited, "with two beautiful women throwing themselves at you, why are you sitting alone in your room jacking off?" Miss Portinari blushed furiously and drank some more champagne to conceal it. She hated the man already, knowing that she would surrender her virginity to him at the earliest opportunity. Of such complexities are intellectual Catholic adolescents capable. "And the boy replied," Hagbard went on, "I guess you just answered your own question, Ma." There was a shocked silence. "The case is quite typical," Hagbard added blandly, obviously finished. "Professor Freud recounts even more startling family dramas." "I don't see," a celebrated French auto racer began, frowning. Then he smiled. "Oh," he said, "was the boy an American?" Miss Portinari left the group, perhaps a bit too hurriedly. She felt a few eyes following her and quickly refilled her champagne glass. A half hour later, she was standing on the veranda, trying to clear her head in the night air, when a shadow moved near her and Cellin appeared amid a cloud of cigar smoke. "The moon has a fat jaw tonight," he said in Italian. "Looks like somebody punched her in the mouth." "Are you a poet, in addition to your other accomplishments?" she asked coolly. "That sounds as if it might be American verse." He laughed, a clear peal like a stallion whinnying. "Quite so," he said. "I just came from Rapallo, where I was talking to America's major poet of this century. How old are you?" he asked suddenly. "Almost 16," she said, fumbling the words. "Almost 15," he corrected ungallantly. "If it's any affair of yours." "It might be," he replied easily. "I need a girl your age for something I have in mind." "I can imagine. Something foul." He stepped further out of the shadows and closer. "Child," he said, "are you religious?"
"I suppose you regard that as old-fashioned," she replied, imagining his mouth on her breast and thinking of paintings of Mary nursing the infant.
"At this point in history," he said simply, "it's the only thing that isn't old-fashioned. What was your birth date?" "Never mind. You must be a Virgo."
"I am," she said.
His teeth would bite her nipple, but very gently. He would know enough to do that.
"But that is superstition, not religion."
"I wish I could draw a precise line between religion, superstition, and science," he smiled. "I find that they keep running together. You are Catholic, of course."
His persistence was maddening.
"I'm too proud to believe in absurdity, and therefore I'm not a Protestant," she replied. immediately fearing that he would recognise the plagiarism.
"What symbol means the most to you?" he asked, with the blandness of a prosecuting attorney setting a trap.
"The cross," she said quickly. She didn't want him to know the truth.
"No," he again corrected her ungallantly. "The Sacred Heart."
Then she knew he was one of Satan's party.
"I must go," she said.
"Meditate further on the Sacred Heart," he said, his eyes blazing like a hypnotist's. A cornball gimmick, he was thinking privately, but it might work. "Meditate on it deeply, child. You will find in it the essential of Catholicism and the essential of all other religion."
"I think you're mad," she responded, leaving the veranda with undignified haste.
But 2 weeks later, during her morning meditation, she suddenly understood the Sacred Heart. At lunchtime, she disappeared, leaving behind a note to the Mother Superior of the convent school and another note for her parents, and went in search of Hagbard. She had even more potential than he realised, and, as elsewhere recorded, within 2 years he abdicated in her favour. They never became lovers.
They were quite good friends, though, and he did fuck her occasionally.
The importance of symbols, images, as the link between word and primordial energy demonstrates the unity between magic and yoga. Both magic and yoga, we reiterate, are methods of self-programming, employing synchronistically connected chains of word, image, and bioenergy. Thus, rationalists, who are all Puritans, have never considered the fact that disbelief in magic is found only in puritanical societies. The reason for this is simple. Puritans are incapable of guessing what magic is essentially all about. It can even be surely ventured that only those who experience true love, in the classic Albigensian or troubadour sense of that expression, are equipped to understand even the most clear-cut exposition of the mysteries. This book has stated it as clearly as possible in a number of places, but some readers are still wondering what we are holding back. The eye in the triangle, for instance, is not primarily a symbol of the Christian Trinity, as the gullible assume, except insofar as the Christian Trinity is itself a visual or verbal elaboration on a much older meaning. Nor is this symbol representative of the eye of Osiris, or even the eye of Horus, as some have ventured. It is venerated, for instance, among the Cao Dai sect in Vietnam, who never heard of Osiris or Horus. The eye's meaning can be found quite simply by meditating on Tarot Trump 15, the devil, which corresponds on the Tree of Life to the Hebrew letter Ayin, the eye. The reader who realises that the devil is only a late rendering of the great god Pan has already solved the mystery of the eye, and the triangle has its usual meaning. The two together are the union of Yod, the father, with He, the mother, as in Yod He Vau He, the holy unspeakable name of God. Vau, the Holy Ghost, is the result of their union, and final He is the divine ecstasy which follows. One might even venture that one who contemplates this key to the identities of Pan, the devil, the great father, and the great mother, will eventually come to a new, more complete understanding of the Christian Trinity itself, and especially of its most mysterious member, Vau, the elusive Holy Ghost. This being has more in common with the ordinary nocturnal visitor, sometimes called a ghost, than is immediately evident to the uninitiated. Cf. the well-documented association of poltergeist disturbances with adolescence. The pentagram comes in two forms, but always represents the fullest extension of the human psyche, the male human psyche in particular. The pentagram with one horn exalted is, quite naturally, associated with the right-hand path. The two-horned pentagram with the left-hand path. The Knights Templar very appropriately inscribed the head of Baphomet, the goat-headed deity who was their equivalent of Pan or the devil, within the left-handed pentagram, in such wise that each horn contained one of Baphomet's horns. It is to be observed that the traditionally sinister left-hand pentagram contains an internal pentagon with one point upward.
This sinister association attributing diabolism to the left-hand path is oversimplified, prejudiced, and superstitious. In general, it can be said that the left-hand pentagram is suitable for both invocations and evocations, whereas the right-hand pentagram is suitable only for evocations. And that is the only important difference.
It is assumed that the reader understands the pentagram as an exclusively male symbol,
whereas the right-hand pentagram contains an internal pentagon with one point downward. This nicely illustrates the law of opposites. Cf. The Tarot Trumps 2 and 3. The Magus, holding one arm upward and one downward, and the High Priestess, sitting between the pillars of day and night.
The Priestess is also associated with the Hebrew letter Gimel, the camel, and part of the meaning of this symbolism is contained in the shapes of the camel's back and the Hebrew letter. The pentagon in the sacred cow is tilted from the perpendicular so that it cannot be said to have any points directly upward or directly downward, or perhaps can be said to have 1.5 points up and 1.5 points down, thereby illustrating the reconciliation of opposites.
This makes it quite useless for summoning werewolves. The sacred cow, however, is intended to teach a philosophical lesson, not to attract individuals with dubious pastimes. All that can be said against the method of the left-hand pentagram, without prejudice, is that this form of the sacrament is always destructive of the Holy Spirit in a certain sense. It should be remembered that the right-hand pentagram method is also destructive in most cases, especially by those practitioners so roundly condemned in chapter 14 of Joyce's Ulysses. And this group is certainly the majority these days. In view of the ecological crisis, it might even be wise to encourage the left-hand method and discourage the right-hand method at this time to balance the sacred numbers.
Very few readers of the Golden Bough have pierced Sir Professor Dr. Fraser's veil of euphemism and surmised the exact method used by Isis in restoring life to Osiris, although this is shown quite clearly in extant Egyptian frescoes. Those who are acquainted with this simple technique of resurrecting the dead, which is at least partially successful in all cases, and totally successful in most, will have no trouble in scrying the esoteric connotations of the sacred cow, or of the Taoist yin-yang, or the astrological sign of Cancer. The method almost completely reverses that of the pentagrams, right or left, and it can even be said that in a certain sense it was not Osiris himself, but his brother Set, symbolically understood, who was the object of Isis's magical workings. In every case, without exception, a magical or mystical symbol always refers to one of the very few variations of the same, fewer than 70 according to a classical enumeration, very special variety of human sacrifice, the one eye opening or the one hand clapping. And this sacrifice cannot be partial. It must culminate in death if it is to be efficacious. The literal-mindedness of the Tsars in the novel caused them to become a menace to life on Earth. The reader should bear this in mind. The sacrifice is not simple. It is a species of cowardice, epidemic in Anglo-Saxon nations for more than 3 centuries, which causes most who seek success in this field to stop short before the death of the victim. Anything less than death, that is, complete oblivion, simply will not work. The magician must always identify fully with the victim and share every agonized contortion to the utmost.
any attitude of standing aside and watching, as in a theatrical performance, or any intellectualisation during the moments when the sword is doing its brutal but necessary work, or any squeamishness or guilt or revulsion creates the two-mindedness against which Hagbard so vehemently warns in Never Whistle While You're Pissing. In a sense, only the mind dies. One will find more clarity on this crucial point in the poetry of John Donne than in most treatises alleging to explain the secrets of magic. The symbolism of the swastika is quite adequately explained in Wilhelm Reich's Mass Psychology of Fascism. Ouroboros, the serpent eating its own tail, is chiefly emblematic of the mass of the Holy Ghost. See Israel Rigardi, The Tree of Life. The Roman Catholic symbolism of the Sacred Heart is strikingly overt, especially to readers of Fraser and Payne Knight. In essence, it is the same notion conveyed by the cartoonist's conventional rendering of Cupid shooting his arrow into a red pulsating heart. This is the basic meaning of the dying God and the resurrection. The identification of Christ with the pelican who stabs its own heart with its beak to feed its young is an analogous rendering of the same motif. We repeat that it was only because the Saar family so misread these simple symbols that they became cruel and sadistic. In essence, then, the basic symbols of magic, mythology, and religion, whether Eastern or Western, ancient or modern, right hand or left hand, are so simple that only the pernicious habit of looking for alleged profundities and mysteries prevents people from automatically understanding them almost without thinking. The meaning of the hexagram, the female equivalent to the male pentagram, was explicated by Freud himself. But most students, convinced that the answer could not be so elementary and down to earth, continue to look into the clouds. The same principles apply to written symbols. The all-important name Yod-He-Vau-He, for instance, has traditionally been scanned in various ways, of which the most significant correlations are given in the following table. Yod, true meaning of the Hebrew letters, fist, or spermatozoon. Traditional magic code, father. Tarot suit, wands. Tarot trump, hermit. Tarot royal card, knight. Element, fire. Hey. True meaning of the Hebrew letters, window. Traditional magic code, mother. Tarot suit, cups. Tarot trump, star. Tarot royal card, queen. Element, water. Vow. True meaning of the Hebrew letters, nail. Traditional magic code, sun. Tarot suit, swords. Tarot trump, hierophant. Tarot royal card, prince. Element, air. Hey. True meaning of the Hebrew letters, window. Traditional magic code, daughter. Tarot suit, pentacles or discs. Tarot trump, star. Tarot royal card, princess. Element, earth. The traditional lion, man, eagle, bull symbolism also fits this table. Yod, the fiery father, is the lion, fire sign. He, the watery mother, is man as humanity. Vau, the air spirit, is eagle. Final, he, earth, is bull. As do Joyce's four old men in Finnegan's Wake. Marcus Lyons, i.e. the lion, is the fiery father. Matt Gregory, i.e. the ego, is the watery mother. John McDougall, i.e. eagle, is the airy son. Luke Tarpe, tower, the bull, is the earthy daughter. Can also be found in the Aztec codices and Buddhist mandalas. The essential and original meaning, of course, is a program for a ritual, and the ritual is magic.
The four letters are simply the four beats in Wilhelm Reich's formula. Muscular tension, dong, dong. Electrical charge, dong, dong. Electrical discharge, dong, dong. Muscular relaxation. In short, as Freud once noted, every sexual act involves, at a minimum, four parties. The father and son provide a fist and a nail. The mother and daughter provide two windows. The case of the Chicago schizophrenic killer, William Hirons, who experienced orgasm when climbing through windows, demonstrates that this symbolism does not have to be taught and is inherent in the human mind, although always subject to the distortion exemplified by the sours. Finally, the universal blessing given on page 218 is intimately involved with the YHVH formula. I bless Ra, the fierce sun burning bright. I bless Isis Luna in the night. I bless the air, the Horus Hawk. I bless the earth on which I walk. The fiery father, the watery mother, the airy son, and the earthy daughter are all there, just as they are in every alchemical formula. In this connection, and also en passant, as an indication that Adolf Hitler's link with the Illuminati was not invented for this work of fiction, we suggest that the reader look into The Morning of the Magicians by Powells and Bergier. But we say no more at this point, lest the reader begin seeking for a 5 equals 4 equation to balance the 5 equals 6. We conclude with a final warning and clarification. Resort to mass sacrifice, as among the Aztecs, the Catholic Inquisition, and the Nazi death camps, is the device of those who are incapable of the true right of the dying God.